future is bright, especially if we build for it. Welcome to Architecting the Future, a podcast for the builders of tomorrow, all about people, process, and technology. We hope you enjoy the show.
So hey, everybody, welcome back to Architecting the Future. I'm excited today to have David Leach, who is a fractional CIO at CBTS. David, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Miles. Let's see if we can educate your audience a little bit on security and risk management.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's a hot topic. So the first question I just wanted to ask you before we get into all the meat is you obviously work fractionally for a variety of companies, but maybe you could just introduce for the audience yourself and a little bit about what CBTS does.
Yeah, certainly. So CBTS trades in the USA. We've got a sister company or a brother company called Onyx. Trades in Canada, and the combined entity provide managed services from infrastructure through to the application stack, value-added reselling and consultancy services, all in really in the technology or IT space. And you know, my role there is in the consulting area, which is separate from all of those other sort of professional services, managed services, selling equipment. We have a firewall between what I produce and what I talk to our clients about and those other parts of the business just to, so that we can become real trusted advisors. And I've got two types of clients. One, where I am a qualified individual operating as their CISO, badged with their identity, with their email, briefing their executives, briefing their board, helping make risk decisions, and we can talk some more about that. And then in other cases, I might be brought in by a CISO to advise on a specific part of their information security strategy, whether or not that's how to improve their identity management, how to improve security of the cloud, et cetera, et cetera. So, I love the job because I get lots of variety. As an advisor, generally, my clients take my advice. They're paying for it. They take it seriously, and they move forward on what we're doing there. So I like building those longer term relationships.
Yeah, very cool. And I'm curious, is there a more high pressure job than being a security advisor in 2023? It feels like MGM's the most recent, but it's intense stuff.
There is an awful lot going on. I think the guys that deserve all of the credit, intensity, are the teams that actually run the security operations teams, the ones that are there every day, pouring through alerts, going threat hunting. They really are in the thick of it. I've never actually been a security operations center leader, but I've led enough data center operations to know exactly what that feels like. That's part of cutting your spurs. As you get more senior, my strategy really is to train the team, trust the team, mentor the team, give them enough rope to not quite hang themselves, but allow them to make mistakes. And then through that mentoring cycle, get them to improve. One of the things I learned very, very early on in my Air Force days was I had shift leads who were empowered to do to change operations, whether or not it was on satellite or intelligence collection. And quite often they made the bad decisions and we lost communications or we didn't capture intelligence. So long as they could explain why they made that decision and what they learned from it, we were all good. So, make the same mistake three times in a row, then that might be a different conversation. So I think using the power of the team is really important to take some of the pressure off, as a leader. And I have to admit, I take downtime. I purposefully block time out. The team can call me on my cell phone if I'm available, but I'm not looking at my email every day. And so everybody's got to find their own balance of how they want to operate. The downside of the way I operate, if I come back from a week's holiday, I've got 900 emails that I've got to sift through. Some people prefer to sift through those every day whilst they're on holiday. My personal preference is to do that on the plane on the way back with a security screen on so that my colleague sat next to me can't read what I'm reading.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting point. And you obviously mentioned the Royal Air Force. So how did that prepare you just for a role in security? I mean, I'd imagine there's a lot of commonality in terms of threat intelligence, innovation, discipline. Yeah, I'd love to hear.
Yes. I think innovation's an interesting one. The military are well known for taking decades to bring a product or a piece of equipment or piece of kit, as we say in England, into service. There are an awful lot of ex-military in the cybersecurity business and a lot of intelligence agency ex-operatives in the same area. I think number one for me at the level I operate in is just the extensive leadership experience and training. And we talked a little bit around that, around building a team. But we're also taught to know your adversary, kind of the art of war type of piece, through detailed defense studies. And so I think that's also very useful, because when you're sort of planning out your defensive strategies, your detection and reaction strategies, having that mindset to think like an adversary, is really, really powerful. And then I mix that in then with just systems engineering. So I try and stay at a high level, but I do try and understand, what an attack vector looks like, what are effective mitigating controls. I see a lot of people in the industry building controls, but they don't really understand how they work or how an adversary would break through them. And so, making them effective is really, really, sort of important. And then lastly, for me, I worked in the world of information operations, cyber operations, and my whole life was spent protecting confidential data, for the warfighter, as we say in the US, and for the operations teams, as we used to say in the UK. So, I've really been in the IT and the security business my whole career. So, bring all those together, and I feel it gives me a kind of a powerful background to build and to operate off of.
And I'm so curious, I'm definitely not a military expert, but as you see the way warfare is changing and how software defined, weapon systems and power grids, I mean, it must be an area of concern, just military cybersecurity, because we kind of live in a world where missiles are hit, shot with buttons. They're not cannonballs like the old days. It's pretty scary stuff that cybersecurity that you were doing is now kind of life and death.
It's very interesting. I mean, Clint, I can't talk about a lot of what I was doing 20 years ago, but the things that we were preparing and had available have now become mainstream. Cyber operations commands are in virtually every single military, every country's military, somewhere in that area, both from a defensive measure and an offensive measure. And so, yes, critical national infrastructure, how fragile it is, our banking sector, our power, just saw a recent report around, water services and how exposed and vulnerable they might be, given going back into ancient times, poisoning a water supply is a really effective tool, to bring an enemy down to its knees. So yeah, it is really worrying. It is really difficult given how our infrastructure is provided by public sector to actually make meaningful steps forward. Without getting into the politics, President Biden's edicts on this space have actually started to make effect, with strategy coming out of the White House into federal agencies and then cascading down through federal agencies, and those federal agencies are now making rules. So we're seeing rules coming out of TSA, we're seeing rules coming out of the FTC, called the Safeguards Rule, to force companies to improve their security stance, and the same on the critical national infrastructure space. So, the risk to society has been noted, and every country is doing something similar.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time, because like you said, I think we do need a centralized initiative, like compliance to some degree, like HIPAA or like, you know, some of the industry specific stuff has done somewhat, but I did want to ask you, I guess, you know, as we get into the nitty gritty, how bad is it out there? I mean, you see these news articles about MGM, but you think for every MGM that was consumer facing, you know, 10 B2B companies are getting hacked and not publishing it on their website. Yeah, how bad is just the landscape in terms of the prevalence of ransomware, of phishing attacks, of all these different things that people might be afraid of?
I think the statistic that is telling is ask a company that is reasonably mature when their last incident was. And an incident there is a confirmed example of somebody exfiltrating some data or having made her system unavailable. And you're probably going to find it's less than a month for a large-scale enterprise. I think that tells the story that in the old days, we used to design with a hard shell and protect, and all our focus was on protecting. Now our focus is on detecting and remediating, and we assume breach as we operate, which is what's led to terms like zero trust, which came about from that realization that the old castle and moat or barbed wire around the key point was no longer effective, and we had to be defense in depth, and we had to assume that the network was breached. And at the same time as that thought process was going along, COVID occurred, and we went to this massive dispersion of the workforce outside of the office. And at the same time, there was an uptick of use of SaaS as a service and external services provided. And so all those things kind of come together to kind of address that reality.
Yeah, it's pretty serious when you talk about that window of being down to a month, and some of them, like the MGM one, are pretty catastrophic how much they affect, money-making operations or social security numbers being taken. Or, I mean, it's pretty scary to think a million socials can be out in the world being bought on the black market like that.
Yeah. And you're aware there's a black industry, a hidden industry selling that stuff, either on the dark web or even just on the regular web. So the classic piece, though, is because we have paid these ransomware payments so much, those threat actors will carry on until that revenue stream dries up. So, think hard is my advice around paying ransomware. If you're in a situation where your company's going to die if you don't pay it, then clearly I can't say that that's wrong for an executive to make that decision. But be prepared. Ransomware is just one particular breach. I think I was reading a Verizon do a really good annual report or State of the Union, if you want, that covers all known and reported incidents globally, and it breaks it out by country and by sector. And if you look at that on an aggregate, about 25-30% of overall incidents could be attributable to ransomware of one shape or another. And for those that are not familiar with ransomware, ransomware is where a threat actor gets into your network and then does one of two things. They either encrypt and lock your systems and your data, or they extract your data and then extort on the basis that they will make that available on the web, perhaps make for free your intellectual property around your special design for a pharmaceutical device, pharmaceutical formulary, et cetera, or just breach and release medical health records. So there's two variants there that, in the lingo, we kind of talk of hack and lock. Data's not available, you go down because your business can't operate, or hack and leak, where your data is made public if you don't pay the ransomware fees. And so virtually every ransomware event in the last 12 months has had both of those modes of operation, and they'll often then throw into it a denial of service attack where they'll hit your website and take your website down through just massive traffic.
Yeah, that's a lot. So ransomware is one. What are some of the other And I know I know you're not a negative person. It's a bleak topic, so I appreciate you explaining. What are some of the other big threats that companies really need to be aware of? And then we can sort of maybe get into the optimistic part of how do we offset them. But what are some of the other big threats?
Yeah, so the term threat has got a very specific meaning. So a threat or a threat actor is somebody who wants to do some bad. You add that with a vulnerability or an access path, if you want, and that then gives you a risk. So, you know, if you're looking at threat actors, then that goes everything from script kiddie, random or opportunistic criminal gangs, hacktivists, and then targeted kind of industrial espionage, and then state level, you know, kind of espionage. So you see all of those groups, you know, active in any one year, and they might, you know, use vulnerable employees, phishing, you know, getting an employee to open up a link and then their credentials are stolen. Perhaps they might get somebody to send them $500 worth of Apple gift cards because the CEO wants to give them out as presents. So you know, you've got that weak human piece, and that human in the loop is massive. Perhaps 80% of incidents have a human in the loop making a mistake, et cetera. And then the other vulnerability in there is, you know, one of my favorites is unpatched or not up to date software or hardware. You know, it is criminal how many companies operate with out of date software. Talking with a client, still got Windows 7 desktops operating. And the reason that those are dangerous is Microsoft stopped releasing security patches, so that there are known vulnerabilities on those devices and there's no way of securing them apart from not putting them on the network. So all of that then kind of leads through to that, you know, perhaps it might be as the risk might be ransomware, it might be business email compromise, you know, leading from that people area. It might be, you know, sort of direct breach of a website, you know, probing in through a website and then moving from there to then commit other malicious activities. And sorry, I missed one other critical vulnerability, cloud misconfiguration. I think Gartner said something like 80% of this last year's incidents in cloud systems were due to misconfiguration by the client. So there's a lot of stuff in there. And how do you get your head around it was the other part of the question. You've got to go through and quantify the risk of each of those and then know where your priorities are and where you sit. Use a framework of leading or best practice. You know, the simple one is the NIST cybersecurity framework. And it then will give you fairly prescriptive lists of things that you should have in your estate to identify the risks, protect, detect, react, and recover. And I may have got one of those areas of work slightly wrong, but that's the general kind of, you know, terminology. So build a security program based on what's been shown to be best practice in the national critical infrastructure space, which is what CSF was built for. And they have now released version 2, which has thrown governance into there as well. And they've acknowledged that, yes, this works really well for any industry or organization, even nonprofit. So, you know, things like MFA, you know, encrypting everything. They're the simple ones.
Yeah, it seems like if you think about it kind of like a low-hanging fruit, user training, multi-factor authentication, I mean, some of these basic things can get rid of, you know, 50% of the threats pretty quickly. There's the 80-20 of, you know, you do that 20%, you protect against 8%. Some of the more complex stuff like cloud configurations, software patching, it seems like that's where an outside expert like you is nice, because you see this, and if a CEO brings you in and you're not going to hide, you know, any information, you'll be able to kind of bring a little bit of positive accountability to, hey, we're a little out of date here. And sometimes maybe there's not that incentive internally.
Correct. And building those metrics where you can actually show where the vulnerabilities are, which team's not patching them, and be that honest middleman providing the governance and highlighting where things are. And, you know, if you're a small enterprise, you know, I love the analogy of, you're out in the forest and, you're wondering how you're going to deal with a bear attack. And it's the usual adage, you've only got to run a little bit faster than the guy next to you. So in security, you know, most of these random opportunistic threat actors, if you're slightly more protected, then they're not going to, they're not going to come after you. They're going to go to the next victim. So, you know, it's not about being everybody at the same level. You know, if you're a national aerospace company, perhaps GE Aerosystems, which is local to me in Cincinnati, you know, they're getting hit all the time, not by random opportunistic. They're getting hit by state sponsored. They have to be so much more mature than a small 500 person SaaS startup. Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting question because it really turns security into a competitive advantage, because not having to pay those fees or downtime or brand reputation or all these issues. I mean, it actually oddly helps you if your competitor doesn't have as much security as you.
And particularly if you're in the IT space and you're a SaaS provider, if you can show you've got all these controls in place, you're more likely to win business when somebody like me gets, sort of asked to assess third-party vendors for their risk portfolio. And, third-party vendors are an attack vector or a risk, to an enterprise. And, SEC just released some rules go into effect the 15th or 18th of December, if I remember correctly, where listed companies have to notify within 4 days of a definition of a breach being material. And that includes third party or vendors. So this is going to be really interesting because, I might be advising a client that is, listed on the NASDAQ. They've got to notify, but one of those vendors might not be a listed company, so they don't have to notify. So we're still working through the nuances of how we do that and how much we have to disclose, how much we don't have to disclose. And that then becomes just a legal conversation, which is, I work regularly with legal counsel to understand the nuances of regulation, and the art of the possible in terms of some of the more offensive-like actions that we sometimes think about from a security perspective.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. So one of my questions for you is, how do you feel like executives or board level leaders need to change their thinking? So you talked about a methodical approach, really getting down to systematizing, but it feels like there's kind of two camps right now. There's people who have experienced this in a painful enough way to care, and they're very on guard and bringing in people like you constantly. Or there's people who are kind of this is not the best, but they don't really understand the gravity. So can you speak to how you see a change in thinking required to really move things forward?
Yeah, and I think I'll just go back to that SEC ruling. That's going to require companies to discuss and disclose how they manage cyber and systemic risk. And so I think that's the piece is they've got to expand how they think about business risk, perhaps business continuity risk, and then expand that into the cyber realm so that they can sort of get a handle on, kind of where they are. They will increasingly be required to sort of divulge that expertise on the board, what those systems are for protecting and managing risk. And so I think that's the main bit. And culturally, many executives, many board members, they want to know how secure we are. They need to start to kind of stop answering that question because they really want the assurance that they're never going to be breached. They should start to ask questions around how will we handle a breach.
Yes, this movement from cybersecurity to resilience, it sounds like,
Yeah. And, many of my colleagues, we're to blame. We get really techie really quickly and, glazed eyes, sort of regularly, sort of seen. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we need to speak in business terms as well. So there's a two-part conversation there. We need to quantify, what is the business risk? We need to be part of that conversation about materiality. and where we're going to set the, the risk thresholds. A startup probably has got a much higher risk tolerance because they're focused about getting a product out, getting their business running. If a cyber event takes them down, well, that's just going to be like their product not working. As they pivot then to become an enterprise, then that risk tolerance should probably come down.
Yes, and I like what you said, because I think the role of why CISO has a C in it as a C-level leader is that you really do need to be having these business-level discussions with the CFO or COO or CEO that's not technical. And so they can understand, and you've done a nice job of that today, like two-factor authentication or MFA sounds really complicated. It's basically checking a box in Gmail that says every user that logs in from a new device has to get a text message verification. It's not as complicated as the buzzword makes it seem. But some of the stuff that you're going to get to, like patching, is definitely. So one question I had is when you move towards resilience, insurance seems like it becomes a lot more important because at some point, if you just can't fully stop being breached or everyone's going to get breached every so often, then all of a sudden it becomes an insurance math problem. And I'm curious, how are you seeing the role of cyber insurance in this? And how do you see that evolving over time?
Wow, we could have a whole podcast on this, Miles, and I know we're going to run out of time here. So how do I characterize that? So insurance is a very effective risk offset mechanism. It's probably a posher word for that. Most companies have some form of insurance, and it really covers the incident response costs that are significant to bring in forensic capable individuals. It brings in the ability to use a ransomware negotiator. There are professional ransomware negotiators out there. The insurance marketplace is really interesting. They really don't understand the risk. They haven't been analyzing it like they have life risk for as many years, and the metrics just aren't there. So what we've seen actually was ramping up premiums up until last year. This year, there's a lot more competition in the marketplace, so we're seeing premiums come in significantly lower. But we expect those to harden, in the coming, in the coming weeks and months, as they begin to realize, kind of where this risk is and this enormity of the number of payouts. They're also getting, as you'll see in the news, really hard about paying out. So if you've got one eye missing or one T cross missing from your activity where you didn't tell them about something, they're refusing to pay, and that's going to litigation and court. So I think we'll see the coverage provided decreasing, if you want. It'll just become partial coverage, just like we do in our car insurance where we're carrying large co-payments or initial payments. That's healthcare, isn't it? Co-pays. But anyway, you're going to see a lot more of that. And every entity is different, just like healthcare. Large enterprises sometimes don't have healthcare insurance. They self-insure for their employees. They're doing the same thing in cyberspace. So again, company culture will dictate which way companies go.
Interesting. So you could get breached one way, unrelated, but say you're supposed to have two-factor on, but you get breached through a software patch, and that voids the entire policy legally.
Potentially, yes.
And so then the company wants to take, but cyber's really not at fault because those were the rules. And yep. So like you said, they're getting smarter about payouts. And then in the future, you see you got to reward the good actors, kind of like health insurance.
Yeah.
And you got to punish the bad actors because it's becoming too difficult for that's a very good take on the market. And you're right, maturity wise, that would make sense because health and life have been around a lot longer than cyber.
Yep.
So they then reaching.
And the actuaries are just now pivoting. So the databases of life actuarial science, go back to the 1700s. We just don't have that much data in this space.
Yeah. So thank you very much, David. We really appreciate you coming on the show, and we look forward to having you back on again soon. If anyone wants to reach out to David at CBTS, feel free to find him on LinkedIn. They do some great cybersecurity work for clients, and I know he'd be happy to talk to you. Thank you again.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Miles.